From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This Sunday, the second presidential election in Ukraine, post-Maidan, will be held. The current president, Petro Poroshenko, will again face off against Yulia Tymoshenko, and a third party, Volodymyr Zelensky, who actually plays the president of Ukraine on a television series, joins them in the top three spots among polls. None of the many candidates are expected to get through the first round Sunday with a majority of the votes. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, international analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow Friday.
Well, the first round of the elections is this weekend. It's on Sunday. And if no candidate gets over 50%, which is the most likely scenario,
right. Yeah.
Then the top two candidates will face off in 3 weeks' times in a second round on April 21st, so 3 weeks from today. Right. And Ukraine, as I'm sure your listeners are all well aware, is in a hurting place. It's a broken society. It's still riven by civil war. There's still the bleeding wound of Crimea walking away from this mess in the aftermath of the West-backed Maidan putsch in 2014, and with Russian help arranging a referendum and voting to leave, get out of Dodge of Ukraine, and reunify with Russia, which has been the source of no end of rounds of sanctions and escalating military tensions between Russia and NATO, with NATO continuing to mass troops on Russia's border, citing the pretense of Russian aggression in all of this. The conflict inside Ukraine with Donbass, and I have to say it's not even, of course, all of Donbass. It's Donbass city itself, really, Donetsk and Lugansk, which are about one third of their respective territories. The rest of those regions even are still controlled by the Ukrainian government. So we're looking, you know, in an area around the size of Connecticut or something like that.
Right.
And it's still a very bad frozen conflict there, with a very bad economic situation there as well. And the fact that nearly every single leader, a standout individual in the resistance there by the people of East Ukraine, every leading figure from the very beginning, most of them are dead. Most of them have been assassinated, and the most recent was the president of the Donetsk Republic, Zakharchenko, who was assassinated by a bomb in a cafe over a year ago. So that is a mess conflict. There was supposed to be resolved by the Minsk agreements,
right,
which, of course, the West-backed putsch regime in Kiev has no intention of fulfilling, because there is a series of steps that were outlined, and the chronological order was quite precise, with the securing of the borders with Russia to be the very last step of the phase, to ensure all the political measures are met beforehand, which includes amnesties and pardons for everyone involved in the civil war, the disbanding of all armed militias, which the Kiev government has solved by just officiating all of these neo-fascist battalions into the armed forces,
right,
and the new National Guard and everything else, for the most part. But a whole step of political measures that would have kept the Donbass, East Ukraine, as part of Ukraine, but with a federated structure.
Right.
That basically, from the Russian perspective, would have ensured that Ukraine doesn't join NATO, but it would have also prevented Ukraine from joining any Russian, you know, the collective security treaty. It would have kept Ukraine as a neutral country, in other words.
Yeah, and also there's a domestic...
And in the civil war. But it's come to nothing. Right. The Minsk agreement, it's a frozen conflict, but there's still artillery shells exchanged every day,
and sniper and
mines that result in a couple hundred deaths on both sides a year. That's as frozen as it gets.
Yeah.
And Russia has no plan B for this. Of course, neither does Kiev or the West.
Right.
Russia's plan B is to hope against hope that some better government, more amenable, government such as it is, authorities in Kiev emerge from this, quote, election, unquote, that might be more serious about, making the compromises in a business type relationship at the least that can, you know, end this, bleeding wound in both countries.
Maybe one way of doing that would be to just have somebody write a script for it. Because looking at the presidential election, for example, according to the polls that they're publishing out here, the candidate that's leading with somewhere between 25% and 33% of the vote is a guy that plays a president of Ukraine on television, Zelensky.
Yeah. Okay, so the three main candidates, there's 39 candidates in this election.
Right.
And first of all, it has to be said, as with the previous elections held by this putsch government, I say elections in quotations marks.
Right.
First of all, because the conflict in East Ukraine continues, it's not merely an election held at the barrel of a gun. It's an election held also under literal grad fire, artillery fire, under the boot of brown shirt militias, all right, like Azov, C-14, right sector still around, any number of them that are, most of them are semi or formally officiated into military and police structures at this point, so it's even worse on that scale. On top of that, the two largest parties in the country up until the Maidan putsch, the Party of Regions, which was basically the party of the East. Ukraine, the East and the South. It wasn't a lot of – you will always see it referred to in the Western press as a pro-Russian
party. Right, it's not that.
It's simply false.
There's an overlay, a demographic overlay of Russian speakers or Russian identifiers and party members in the East, because geographically, that's the demographics of the region. But it is not accurate to say this is a pro-Russia party. Otherwise, those people would have been part of Russia a long time ago.
No. It is not. I mean, it's complicated, but this whole thing is about Ukrainian identity, about a split in Ukrainian identity between West Ukraine and East Ukraine, with East Ukraine being friendly to Russia, or at least not actively hostile to Russia, and majority Russian-speaking, whether they are ethnic Russians, which is about 25%. 24-25% of the Ukrainian population, before Crimea anyway, a West Ukraine, which is the highest Ukrainian-speaking part of the country. We're talking Galicia, the Lvov, Ternopil, and so on, that the part of Ukraine that actually wasn't Ukraine up until the World War II era, because for centuries that area had been owned by the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and the Austro-Hungarian Empire after that.
Right.
And they have a very anti-Russian, anti-leftist, anti-Soviet, if you want, sense of Ukrainian identity. And Central Ukraine doesn't have a strong sense of Ukrainian identity, and they go basically whatever way the current political trend and wind is blowing and is best secured for their pocketbook.
Right.
And this conflict goes on. The Party of Regions was a party that represented the interest of the East Ukrainian oligarchs, right? Because all Ukrainian politics was and still is about the oligarchs. Right. They've never had a Putin. They never had a president in the post-Soviet era that drove the oligarchs out of the political realm and said, if you want to keep your ill-gotten lucre, you stay out of politics.
Right.
They've never had that. So continually, both the media and politics in Ukraine, everything essentially, is controlled by different oligarchs, that arrange in rough, groups of at least temporary aligned interests and so far. And the Eastern Ukrainian oligarchs, most of them were represented in the Party of Regions. And that party, at least rhetorically, tried to represent the interest of Eastern Ukrainians in the sense that it wasn't pro-Russian, but it was not, it at best what can be said is it was not rabidly anti-Russian.
Right.
That is the definition of pro-Russian that we forced to come. If you're not rabidly anti-Russian, then you're pro-Russian.
Because let's look at the split. I mean, the beginning of the split, political split, after the coup, part of the coup, what were the first motions that were taken by the coup government had nothing to do with trying to correct the horrible economic situation facing the country that was the source of the unrest that enabled the coup in the first place, but rather, let's make the people that speak Russian in the eastern part of the country not be allowed to speak Russian in the schools or in business anymore. That this was the highest priority of those people, was to attack the people on the other side of the country, which, of course, created or certainly exacerbated whatever split existed in the society.
Yeah, those were the first measures, many of the first measures put forward by the new regime they seized power in 2014. They were shelved quietly under Western pressure and direction, somewhat in the beginning. They were put on the cold burner because the West realized how divisive that would be. But in the last year and a half, those have come on full bore again, and you literally see the Russian language being forbidden on the airwaves, showing movies. It goes a lot farther. I mean, you have Western journalists who take a critical opinion of the regime in Kiev, and they're barred from entering the country, whether they're Austrian, Italian, and so on. And it's another thing that's just simply not recognized by the Western media, or really talked about by Reporters Without Borders or the International Committee to Protect Journalists. But between 2014 and 2018, there were close to 20 journalists and media workers that were killed in Ukraine, and nearly every one of them was critical of the new government in Kiev.
They're fighting over all these, ethnic identities that are supposedly so alien one to the other. I'm remembering back in the 60s at the United Nations when a number of the Soviet republics, including Ukraine and Lithuania, had separate seats from the USSR's seat at the United Nations under the theory that these were separate nationalities, in terms of an ethnicity, the ethnic part of a nation state. And that was a hilarious joke to the Western media that there was some ethnic difference between Ukrainians and Russians and Lithuanians that was being exploited almost for comic relief at the USSR. And they've spun on a dime now, and it's of course they're going to be hostile to each other. These were almost bred in their DNA to be hostile to each other. It's such a huge change in the subtext of the coverage from the West.
Yeah, there's such a problem with ethnicity in this part of the world, and I mean the idea of the ideology of nationalism, that the borders of a political state should be congruent with an ethnic population. It's a European ideology.
Right.
It's probably the most dangerous and the most powerful ideology in world history. Even Lenin, as he decried it, used it to help solidify the Soviet Union in right. the early days. But, it has caused hundreds of years of fratricidal and genocidal warfare in Europe in order to create a France where the people are majority French.
Yeah, with all the French people,
and so on.
Right. And, I mean, the same thing, the same thing was weaponized and turned on its head by the colonial powers. As they were mapping up the world, they would say, okay, well, here's where this people are, so we're going to draw a line down the middle. Yep. We'll take half of them and half of their enemies and put them in one nation state, and you take the other half, and they'll be fighting with each other instead of fighting us off the continent, and then the two nation states will be fighting with each other as proxies of the colonial powers.
Yeah, it's even more of a joke, of course, in the Middle East with the divvying up of the French, British, and the Ottoman empires, Sykes-Picot, and so on. But, I mean, we still have problems with it today in Europe. I mean, the Yugoslav wars, you know, the 20th anniversary of that, they are wars of ethnic and national identity. And it's continuing on in Ukraine to this day. And at the same time that Western Europe has moved away from nationalism, and the EU has in many ways become a nation deconstructing machine, specifically designed to remove this idea of ethnic nationalism from the body politic. We are all Europeans and so on, now that it's no longer convenient with the new liberal cosmopolitan ideology of the EU. But at the same time, this type of ethnic nationalism is promoted in Eastern Europe, in Poland, and even more particularly in the Baltics and in Ukraine now, Moldova even, as long as the hostility of these nations that are being manufactured is against Russia. And that's the sorry truth. It's weaponized nationalism against Russia for Eastern Europe, right? While we try to get rid of nationalism in its entirety, dissolve the body politics with immigration and everything else, EU cosmopolitanism in the West. So it's really extremely hypocritical and repulsive. And Ukraine is foremost a conflict amongst Ukrainians about Ukrainian national identity. And the Party of Regions, like I said, it was a not rabidly anti-Russian party of Eastern Ukrainian oligarchs that claimed to represent the people of East and South Ukraine. And if you look at the votes from South and East Ukraine, you see that that's where all their votes came from. And and it was a very powerful voting bloc because it was more or less unified. But at the same time, Yanukovych was pushed by his advisor, Manafort, this is where this whole connection gets into it, towards accepting an EU association agreement.
Which is the Project Clinton's people.
By Yanukovych, by the Party of Regions.
Right. And this is the Project Newland. Newland and Clinton's people and Obama's people and Kerry's people all were pushing for this project, and Manafort was working on the same side as them.
And Yanukovych's big problem was he tried to govern towards Western Ukraine or center Ukraine, including Kiev, rather than to his own base in the east. Despite all his promises, he didn't do much to help protect Russian language rights and cultural rights. And he pushed towards this EU association agreement up until the very last minute. He campaigned, he convinced people in East Ukraine that it would help them economically, help the country. And then at the very last minute, when he saw the diktat, this neoliberal shock therapy diktat that he was given, without any of the tens of billions of dollars he expected to receive in order to help ameliorate the effects. I mean, mass privatizations of state companies, massive increases in gas, heating, and other utilities.
Jeffrey Sachs did it 20 years earlier. We, I mean, you know.
Mass unemployment. Yeah, I mean, the 90s, you know, on steroids all over again. And he said no, or right. at least no, not right now, not under these conditions.
Right.
And then turned at the last moment to accept the loan from Russia, which Russia has to this date lost $15 billion.
Right.
And that spiraled into the Maidan protests and the overthrow of the government with right. the open support and orchestration of Western officials on the ground.
On the ground.
In
on
Kiev,
stage in
encouraging
Kiev.
Crowds of people that were talking about overthrowing the government, funding their propaganda outlets like Euromaidan PR, which was the biggest towards organizing, and putting out a narrative for the Maidan. It's the Maidan Euromaidan TV station. The 24-hour tagline for the last 2 months across the screen was literally revolution. And this was funded openly, acknowledged by the U.S.
Yep.
and the State Department of the Netherlands. They're proud of this, right?
Right.
But that's
yep.
not meddling, right?
Right?
I mean, it goes so far beyond meddling that
is
in my mind an open push.
Yeah, right.
But so the Party of Regions, this Party of East Ukraine, was lustrated and pogromed out of existence. So the people of East Ukraine are without any real representation. The second biggest party in the country, also a party majority of South and East Ukraine, was the Communist Party.
Right.
It was kind of a reform Communist Party. It mostly fought for social benefits and so on. And again, they were not pro-Russian, but they weren't rabidly anti-Russian. They were literally banned. Them and three other leftist parties in the country were banned. So, I mean, not only do you have, you know, the continuing conflict, the voting under the barrel of a gun in Grad and stormtroopers, but you have multiple parties, the parties that represented East and South Ukraine before 2014, either lustrated, banned, and or pogromed out of existence. And so the entirety of the real political representation of East and South Ukraine at this point is this FA-manufactured opposition bloc, as it's called, which is basically the East Ukrainian oligarchs who acquiesced to the Maidan.
Right.
And they're polling around 10% in the polls, right? They have no chance of getting elected, and they're basically the main candidate, Boyko, is running simply – it with the eye towards parliamentary elections, Rada elections, which take place 6 months later,
right?
So in the fall.
So he's been, the lowest polls I see for him are like 7.6, and they go up to 12.6, but it seems like most of them are between 9.5 and 10%, like you say.
So these elections, you know, elections, quote unquote, with all these banned parties and under threat of a gun, as in, you know, previously in 2014 and 2015, the turnout in East Ukraine is abysmal, right? We're talking 30-40% because people realize that it's all rigged, that it's all against them. And the latest polls, Gallup polls, show that Ukraine has, for the second year in a row, Ukraine has the lowest level of confidence in their government in the world. 9% confidence for the second year in a row.
Yep.
And this is after what was supposed to be a popular revolution
uprising.
Of dignity.
Right.
That's the way it was represented in the Western press.
Right.
And on top of that, the same poll shows that only 12% of Ukrainians believe that their elections will be free and honest.
On the up and up, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what we're going into. So there's 39 candidates running in these quote elections that, you know, that are allowed to run, of course. And of course, the current oligarch, again, oligarchs to understand Ukrainian politics. The oligarch president, the chocolate king, who also owns one of the major TV channels in the country, Petro Poroshenko, who was also, coincidentally enough, the largest, as reported in the Ukrainian press, the largest domestic funder of the Maidan protests in the country, who just coincidentally became the president afterwards.
Wow, funny how that happens.
Right? Yeah, funny how that happens. He is still running. He has one of them. I mean, there are no popular political figures in the country.
Yeah.
First of all, understand that. The people are fed up. They hate everyone.
Yeah.
And that includes the figures in the few these opposition in the East as well. Petro Poroshenko's disapproval rating is 77%. That makes Clinton's disapproval rating look good, right? I mean, he's running on an extremely nationalist platform on his own created party, the Petro Poroshenko bloc, where his slogan is literally army, language, faith. You can't get a more nationalist platform than that. And by that he means, of course, the Ukrainian language.
And he's like, you know, a suit and tie, clean shaven wearing version of those things, because they are the guys that actually goose step around that stuff with the funny flags and everything.
Poroshenko was originally no nationalist, right? Don't make a mistake. He was an opportunistic oligarch.
He's a greedy dude.
He had a position in the previous government that he helped overthrow, the Yanukovych government, and the government before that, and enriched himself off of all of these. Right. And he's enriched himself off of this. By his own reporting of his wealth, has supposedly increased 80% in the last year or two.
If Martians took over the world, he would get himself elected as a delegate to the Martian legislature or whatever from Ukraine. That's what he is.
He's smart enough to know that these Banderite, in the name of Stefan Bandera, the genocidal Nazi collaborating West Ukrainian leader in World War II of the OUN and UPA, they fought the Maidan into power on the streets of Kiev. Right. They kept the government in power in the beginning by waging the war against East Ukraine while the new regime consolidated a military that wanted nothing to do with them, you know, and then it took months to get control of them with purges. And they continue to keep the country, particularly the East and the South, repressed through these new semi-official battalions and so on. I mean, Azov is just one of them, if the largest. Right. And Azov's a large... They created a new national Druzina, which is national fighters, which is kind of a parallel police force, the way it's set up. And it gets composed largely, most of former Azov or current former Azov members and some other of these Banderite battalions. And they are doing election monitoring during this election.
Yeah.
I mean, that's free and fair election, right? Okay. Meanwhile, neo-fascists, literal neo-fascists, that the U.S. Congress previously had a specific bill forbidding arms to being transferred to these people in Ukraine. But, I mean, they helped the government get in power. Poroshenko realizes that he needs them to maintain power, both on the street and electorally.
Yeah.
I mean, they're his last hope anyway.
Yeah.
But a lot of them have turned against him, and some of them have now sided with Yulia Tymoshenko, which is the second Maidan candidate.
And she's got a new hairdo too. It looks like
She's given up on the faux folk braids and is going for the hipster kind of look, post hipster look.
Yeah, so we've got about a minute and a half, Mark. So what do you think is going to happen?
Okay, so Zelensky, this dark horse comedian who possibly is supported by the oligarch Kolomoisky, who has had a falling out with Poroshenko and Tymoshenko, he may be he's leading in the polls, and he will probably win the first round, and then it all comes down probably to be between him and Poroshenko in the second round. Zelensky is expected to win, but of course he's got no party supporting him. He's got no real platform. He is originally from the East. His politics, he plays a president on TV. You can actually watch the show on Netflix. It's called Servant of the People, and you can watch it in the U.S. on Netflix. I encourage you to do. If you watch that show, you'll understand as much about the man who is a black box as the rest of us. It's hoped that he may be more pragmatic. He's running on kind of a post-political protest vote, anti-corruption. He's promising referendums to dissolve major issues.
He's promising what's on the teleprompter. We got to stop there, and we'll pick this up next week, and we can see what the vote actually turned out for the first round. And thanks, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. thanks for listening.